morning, everyone. Thank you so much for hosting me today. Thank you, Reverend Brand, for the invitation. And again, I do apologize that I'm going to be stepping out early and missing an opportunity to hear from Reverend Glasser as well. So excited to talk about Simcha on the crankiest day of the year. Everyone's still rubbing their eyes. No one's sure what time it is exactly. So if you're seeing double vision, blurry vision looking at me today, I very much appreciate everyone coming. And hopefully we could cheer you up a little bit today, even though the title sounds a little morbid maybe. Hopefully I won't be the Grinch that stole Purim. So hopefully we can kind of talk about a different idea, a deeper idea maybe of Simcha. So let's first imagine a scenario. Let's imagine that you're sitting here. Unfortunately, I'm not going to do this today. But let's say you're all sitting here, and suddenly someone's going to come over to you and hand you a card. And on that card, there's a silver dollar attached to it. And the card, if you could actually turn to the last page 8 of the handout. The silver dollar is attached to one of two cards. One of the cards is the top one. It reads, "The Smile, this is for you. The Smile Society, a student community secular alliance. We like to promote random acts of kindness. Have a nice day." That's the first card. The second card is pretty close to the first card, just slightly different. It says, "This is for you," and it adds these words, "Who are we?" The Smile Society, etc., etc. And then it adds another line, "Why do we do this?" And then it gives the other explanation. "We like to promote random acts of kindness." Very similar cards. If you had to predict, if you had to guess, just by a show of hands, who would think that you would feel happier after receiving the first card without the explanation, "Who are we and why do we do this?" Okay? All right? And how many people think they would feel happier if they received the second card? Okay, from this very scientific survey, it appears the majority says the second card. Keep this in mind, I'll get back to this, okay? So we think right now the second card, when it says, "Who are we and why do we do this?" It would make people feel a little bit happier. Keep that in mind, I'll get back to that a little bit later. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Adar and about Simcha. So we're familiar with the famous line in the Gemara about talking about the Simcha of Adar. And we sing the songs, we know, if you ask anybody, what's the happiest month of the year, we'll instinctively say Adar. If we look at the Gemara, which is seemingly a pretty simple Gemara, I think there's a lot of it's pretty complex and it's pretty subtle. We could see a lot of different confusing things perhaps from a seemingly simple Gemara. So the Gemara in Tanis says, "Amar Rav Yehuda Brei Rav Shmuel Bar Shilas Mishmei Derav, Kesheim Shemishenechnas Av Mematin Besimcha." Just like, and hold on to that thought of just like we reduce our joy in the month of Av, Kach Mishenechnas Adar Marben Besimcha. So too in Adar we increase our joy. So, couple questions, just from that simple one line. First of all, why Adar? What's so special about Adar? Okay, that assumes that there is something special about Adar that engenders increased joy, or that we should increase our joy in Adar. What does this comparison with Av add? Why do we have to parallel Av with Adar? And finally, and I'll actually throw this out to the crowd. What does this mean? What does it mean to be Marben Besimcha? Did we say Tachman this morning? At least toss his bone. No Tachman. We say Tachman every day. Are there specific things that we do to increase our Simcha? If I ask you, what do we do in Av to decrease our joy? We can list off a lot of answers, right? We know what we do in Av to decrease our joy. What do we do in Adar? So it's already a little bit ambiguous. And then we look at Rashi, Rashi might deepen the mystery a little bit. Source number 2, Mishenichnas Adar. Why do we increase our joy when Adar comes in? Yemei Nisim Hayuli Yisrael, Purim Pesach. These are days of Simcha, Purim, and Pesach. So already, just from reading Rashi, it seems like there's nothing inherently unique about Adar per se. It's just because of the juxtaposition with Nisan, the fact that there happened to be Yemei Simcha, there happened to be miracles that happened in Adar, juxtaposed with another month, 2 months in a row. Okay, so then maybe now that's why we increase our Simcha, because we have 2 months in a row. And in fact, Rav Yaakov Emden says that had it not been for the juxtaposition, based on Rashi, we would have not had increased simcha. In Kislev, we don't have increased simcha because of Hanukkah. So it's just, Adar doesn't happen to be, it doesn't seem like there's something inherently unique to Adar. It's just the juxtaposition between Adar and Nisan. And in fact, that's why the Elia Rabbis explains that actually, Mishnechnas and Nisan marben besimcha as well, because it's a juxtaposition. It's the same thing. These are two consecutive months of miracles that happened. So, now already a mystery. So it doesn't seem like there's something necessarily so unique about Adar. And what does marben besimcha mean? Like I said before, what do we actually do to increase our simcha? So Chassam Sofer, in source number 3, he raises a pretty startling point. If you actually look at the Rambam and Shulchan Aruch, we don't paskin. They don't paskin Mishan Nechnas Adar marben besimcha. They do paskin Mishan Nechnas Av Mematin besimcha. They paskin part of half of the Gemara, but they actually don't paskin the Mishan Nechnas Adar marben besimcha part of the Gemara. So again, this we know the songs. We know the saying. We know the line. We see the signs. But again, even the Rambam and Shulchan Aruch don't necessarily even bring down the halacha, this idea of Mishan Nechnas Adar marben besimcha. Chassam Sofer explains why they, and it, I should note, though, however, that other poskim, Magen Avraham, Chai Adam, Aruch HaShulchan, Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, do bring down Mishan Nechnas Adar marben besimcha. But again, it still remains somewhat of a mystery. Why would the Rambam and Shulchan Aruch, why would they leave it out? He gives two answers to explain. The first, and they're pretty similar. The first answer is that this Gemara, the Gemara in Tanis that I read before, Mishan Nechnas Adar marben besimcha, goes according to Rav. Rav holds, and I'm not going to go through all the drashos here, based on certain drashos, that the entire month of Av is mematin besimcha, not just until Tisha B'Av or Yud B'Av. It's the entire month of Av is mematin besimcha. And that's why we can learn the contra-opposite. We can learn the opposite by Adar, that Mishan Nechnas Adar marben besimcha. But since we don't possibly like Rav, that the entire month of Av is mematin besimcha, therefore, it follows that we won't paskin like Rav by Adar, that we're marben besimcha. And he says, the reason why the Shulchan Aruch and Rambam bring it down still, halacha by Av, is because, okay, when it comes to bad mazel, we'll paskin it, we'll be a little bit careful by bad mazel, just to protect ourselves. But by Adar, we don't actually paskin it. According to that first answer, Chassam Sofer, we do not paskin, we do not hold that there's something special about the simcha of Adar. According to the second answer, Chassam Sofer, pretty similar. He explains that we don't hold weak paskin in the Gemara and Shabbos, that there's no mazel Yisrael. We don't apply the concept, we don't hold that there's a concept of mazel that applies to Klal Yisrael. Therefore, by Adar, there's no simcha, we do not assume that there's an increase of simcha, because there's no mazel for Klal Yisrael. So we don't assume that this is an especially auspicious time for Klal Yisrael. However, by Av, we do assume that there's mazel for the rest of the world. All non-Jews have special mazel. So therefore, by Av, we have to be careful about the negative, about the positive mazel that the rest of the world enjoys. Therefore, we have to be suspicious of that. Therefore, we'll paskin mematin besimcha because of the it's an auspicious time for the rest of the world. So according to these two answers, both these answers, Chassam Sofer, we do not hold Mishan Nechnas Adar marben besimcha lehalacha. Astounding. Second answer, next source. Source number 4. Lubavitcher Rebbe, in his letters, he explains, he also seems to agree that we don't paskin lalacha, Mishan Nechnas Adar marben besimcha, that there's something special about Adar. He explains that this Gemara, again, is also like Rav. And Rav, if you look, Rav is also another Shita who holds. He explains there's a contradiction in Pesukim and Koheles. One Pasuk seems to assume that Simcha is a positive thing, and we praise Simcha. Another pasuk seems to say that simcha is a dangerous thing. There's no point; it's purposeless. And Rav explains that resolves the contradiction by explaining positive simcha is simcha shel mitzvah. Non-positive simcha is any mitzvah that's not directly related to any simcha that's not directly related to a mitzvah. And Lubavitcher Rebbe says we reject this perspective. We reject this Weltanschauung. We don't say that this is the proper perspective on simcha. We actually, the Rambam and Hilchos Deos and the Ramah, Paskin, that simcha should be ever present, all the time. related to Simcha, not related to Simcha, there's a mitzvah to always be besimcha. So since the Shita of Rav that would say that typically Simcha is not good, but maybe an Adar will make the exception, we don't paskin like that. We paskin you should be besimcha every day. And according to the Lubavitcher to Rebbe, therefore, Mishnechmas Adar Marbin besimcha, again, nothing special. We should always be Marbin besimcha all year long, perhaps, probably not except with the exception of Av. So again, sorry to, so far I sound like the Grinch. I know, hopefully I'll ungrinchify myself, but right now we're still saying that it seems like there's nothing inherently special about the Simcha of Adar. The next source. In the Nemukei Or HaChaim, the Munkantra Rav, Rav Chaim Elazar Shapira, he suggests a very, I think, a beautiful idea. The reason why we codify and we define the halachos of reducing our simcha is because we don't, chas v'shalom, want people to become despondent and to become depressed and to become in deep, bitter pain and av. We need to codify it. We need to set very specific parameters of how we're mematin ba'av. Because if we didn't set parameters, Chazal were afraid that we would just lose all hope. We'd become hopeless in all areas. But really, that's not true. The reason why we codify how we're mematin besimcha in Av, how we reduce our joy in Av, is because only in those specific areas should we reduce our joy. In all other areas, you should have simcha, you should increase your betachon. Yes, we should be sad about the Beis HaMikdash in very specific areas. But other than that, we do not want people to reduce their joy. We want to protect people from falling into a deep depression. But by Adar, we don't want to codify it. We want the exact opposite. We don't want to say, be besimcha in this and this and this area. No, be besimcha in every area you possibly can be. It is all pervasive. You should have full simcha in every single area of your life. We don't want to codify it. Codifying it would limit it. We don't want to limit it in any way. Find simcha in all possible ways. The simcha of Adar should be all pervasive. I'm not going to discuss it right now, but the Pachad Yitzchak Maimer Lamed, I believe, has a very beautiful idea, different, but a very beautiful psychological idea of why the simcha of Adar also should be all pervasive. But the Munkacha Rebbe actually ends in Tzarachian. He says, but this doesn't really answer the question. It's true that we don't want to codify it, maybe, perhaps, because we don't want to limit the simcha of Adar, the joy of Adar. We want it to be all pervasive. However, he brings down other sources. The Rambam, all the time in Hilchos Deos and other areas, he does not limit the joy of, he does not just codify things which have specific halachos. He does codify chovos halavavos, psychological concepts that don't necessarily have a practical application in real life. So in theory, it's still a question because the Rambam, in theory, should have still codified this area as well, even if there are no specific practical elements and even if it's all pervasive. Finally, one more, then the next source, Rav Asher Weiss, in his Minchas Asher, he says a similar idea. He explains that the Simcha experience of Purim, perhaps we could explain that the Simcha experience of Purim parallels this idea of the Simcha experience of Adar. Shulchan Aruch Paskins, confusing psak that is a little bit surprising, that people are allowed to get married on Purim. Even though we have an idea by Yontif or other areas, Ein Marvin Simcha B'Simcha, you're not allowed to intermix certain areas, certain experiences of joy with other experiences of joy. By Purim, people are allowed to get married, according to the Shulchan Aruch. He brings down a psak from Rav Zolti, former chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, in his Tshuvos and Mishnah Siavitz, that shows that there's actually no concept of simcha inherent to the day of Purim. There are experiences that we do that might engender simcha, but as part of the inherent value of the day, there's no simcha on Purim. That's why there's no problem in Marvin simcha b'simcha. The simcha of getting married is not intermixed with any other simcha. There's no inherent simcha of Purim. Rav Asher Weiss explains differently. He explains based on Gemara and Megillah. Gemara and Megillah explains, hey, I'm amazed, that you're allowed to build certain buildings, structures that engender simcha. You're allowed to plant certain types of planting that is specified, that is designated for simcha purposes on Purim, even though we normally dissuade people from engaging in malacha on Purim. So if it's true that we do not want people to engage in malacha, we should also, it should preclude these kinds of actions as well. Why are these actions allowed on Purim? So Rav Asher Weiss explains that on Yontif, we want people to celebrate in a Yontif-tik way. There's a simcha should be celebrated in a Yontif-tik way. Women should be able to buy nice clothing, children should get candies, we should eat meat and drink wine. So Yontif, we should. It's, there's a prescribed way to feel simcha in a Yontif takeaway, the way that people celebrate a chag. However, on Purim, the joy is even more pervasive, and one should try to seek simcha in any way one can. It's very similar to the Nemuke or Achaim. One should, if you, planting makes you besimcha, plant. If building this beautiful building makes you feel simcha, build. Even if it's not directly related to Purim, do things that make you happy on Purim. It's a big mitzvah. This idea is similar, that you should find simcha in all areas of life. If it's directly related to the mitzvah or not directly related to mitzvah, very similar to the Munkat Rebbe. And he explains at the end, just tangentially, that's why there's a special idea of learning Torah on Purim, not necessarily related to the day of Purim itself, but because of the joy that learning Torah brings. Finally, one more answer, the fourth answer of why Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam do not paskin Mishnah Nechazad or Marv V'Simcha is found in the Yalkut Yeshuni, Rav Gershom Stern. He explains an opposite idea to Lubavitcher Rebbe and perhaps to this idea of Rav Asher Weiss that I just explained. He explains that reducing joy, being mematen besimcha, is easier to do in a L'shem Shemayim way. There's no self-serving interest when you reduce joy. That's why we're comfortable codifying it, because we don't assume that there would be ulterior purposes or ulterior reasons why people would be doing it. However, by odds are, to increase joy, then there might be some self-serving purposes. It may not be purely L'shem Shemayim. So we're concerned. We don't want people to be able to. We don't want to codify something that might have some self-serving interest and might increase joy outside of the concept, the precept of a simcha shel mitzvah. So we do not codify it. Again, that's the opposite, because according to Rav Asher Weiss, Lubavitcher Rebbe, you should find joy in all areas of life all the time. Here we're saying we do not want to codify it. We do not want to say that. We want to limit the joy. We want to make sure that it's totally in the most pure, directly related to a mitzvah kind of way. And again, according to this answer, the Yalkut Yeshuni, we do not paskin halacha mishnah nechasad or marvim simcha. Very surprising. So that's four answers. So let's try to figure this out. Any questions so far? Yes.
On that last one, do you find that compelling? The idea that there's no way to find an ulterior motive in mishnah nechasad and mamayit with the simcha. I mean, to me, it strikes me that it is possible to imagine that people would have an easier time in marvim the simcha and doing it for reasons that have nothing to do with Purim. But it's also easy to find reasons to mamayit the simcha. Junior credentials here, but that just strikes me as not very convincing.
I think his point was, if I could speak for him, is that it's easier. Mm-hmm. It's easier. There's less of a trap, and I think that that's understandable. It is true that there could be, in some way, I don't think it's self-serving, I think it'd be self-defeating, but there are self-defeating purposes of reducing joy, that's true, that wouldn't necessarily be L'shem Shemayim, but I think it's easier to codify that without the concerns of it becoming not L'shem Shemayim. Yes? Okay, good question, I don't know, good question. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so now with that in mind, now that I've already kind of, hopefully not, but dampened what we assume is the joy of Adar a little bit, let's try to figure out perhaps why there's this mysterious element to Adar. We don't know what is so special about Adar, if it's inherent to Adar, we don't know if we paskin it, and if it's only by Av, so let's try to figure this out a little bit. Let's look at a Gemara in Brachos, which I think very much parallels the Gemara in Tanis. Now, I said before, I pointed out that we say an interesting line. We say an interesting word there. I think it's very interesting. We say kishem shemishin nechnasav marvin mesimcha mishin nechnasav mematim mesimcha kishem. Why are we? What does kishem mean? Just like. So let's say it in English. Just like we increase our joy in a month, we also decrease our joy in another month. That's not kishem. What's just like? It's the opposite. And even if you want to say kishem, that there's, you could say a very convoluted sentence. Just like there is a change in direction of joy in a month, there's also a change of direction in another month. Change of direction of joy in another month. Even if you want to say that convoluted sentence, why? Why the need to parallel them? It's pretty self-evident. Why do we have to directly connect them? So let's look at Gemara and Brachos. Source number 9. The Mishnah says that you are obligated to bless Hashem for the bad things that happen. Kishem, just like you bless Hashem for the good. So we see a strong parallel here. Just like something bad, there's one kind of reaction to something negative that happens. Also, there's another kind of reaction, kishem. It's just like we have another kind of reaction for something good. So the Gemara is sensitive to this word, kishem. My chayv levarech al rok, kishem shem avarech al tova. What does that mean? Kishem. How are they the kishem? Ilema kishem shem avarech al tova, hatova metiv, kach mevarech al ra, hatova metiv. If you want to say that it's kishem, it's just like in the fact that we say the exact same bracha, we use the exact same words. When good things happen to us, we make the bracha of atova metiv. But when bad things happen, we know we say baruch dayin ha'emes. So it's not kishem, Gemara is saying. We say different brachos when good things happen and when bad things happen. The Gemara gives a shocking answer. How is it kishem? What's kishem about it? Amar Rava, lo nitzrucha ela lekabulinu besimcha. Both types of experiences, for tragedies and for good news, when these things happen, what's kishem? How are they the same? How are they kishem? They should both be done besimcha. So, when tragedies happen to us, we should be besimcha? Is that really what's expected of us?
Because it could be worse.
Unfortunately, it could be worse. And unfortunately, even when things are worse, because we should still be besimcha, apparently. Even when things are worse.
Oh, it's true. There's so many ties, it's like nothing's worth spilling debt.
And yet, according to Gemara, it should be done besimcha. What does simcha mean?
Joy.
Joy. Okay. So, let's see what Rashi says simcha means. Thank you. Well, let's see what Rashi says. L'kabulina besimcha. What does this word besimcha mean? Does simcha mean joy? L'varech amidos pronos belevav shalem. Belevav shalem. So, what does levav shalem mean? Simcha is a very complicated word, and I believe simcha has a different meaning in different kinds of contexts. I don't think that simcha always means this outward celebration, as I think is evident from this Gemara and this Rashi. Simcha, and I should say, perhaps for the truly, truly, unfathomably unique amongst us, it's perhaps conceivable, I personally cannot, that Chas v'Shalom, when a tragedy happens, they could accept it with some level of simcha, knowing that this is the plan min ha-shamayim. Perhaps. I have a hard time believing in the worst tragedies that we should be outwardly joyous when that happens. But perhaps that's an ideal level. Perhaps. But I think from what Rashi is saying, that to be belevav shalem means, it doesn't necessarily mean how Americans in the United States typically use the word happiness, or typically conceive of the concept of happiness. It means to have a sense of belevav shalem, have a sense of deep-rooted passion, have a sense of meaning, of commitment. Belevav shalem. That seems to be a different idea of simcha. And in fact, even this is not a unique expression of simcha. There happened to be an article a couple weeks ago in the Washington Post about how different cultures use the word joy and happiness. In American culture, happiness seems to be typically pretty self-serving, the way we kind of define happiness, like an internal, like more pleasure-based is how typically we use the word happiness. But in even in ancient Greek, when Aristotle used the term eudaimonia, it's really translated, not that I'm a Greek expert by anyone's definition in the entire universe, but based on an article I read, it should be more precisely defined as the feelings accompanying behavior in the direction of and consistent with one's true potential. It's very different than how we typically perceive of the word happiness. And other cultures perceive of the word happiness and use the word happiness. Their individual words of happiness, they typically have either a more collective experience or a more meaning-based expression.
There's a theme in psychology and social work, content versus process. The founding fathers, way back in the 18th century, were involved with process, the pursuit of happiness. It's a process of consecutive events,
of
a process of events, not a finite event.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Right. So, specifically, what is the process? The process is not necessarily about increasing as much pleasure for ourselves as possible, but perhaps finding meaning. Now, with this being said, now we can perhaps understand our kashem differently in our Gemara. Perhaps these are very parallel experiences. I wouldn't even say dichotomous experiences. I would say they're integrative experiences, the experiences that we feel in Adar and the experiences that we feel in Av. It's possible that we're not just saying that kashem. What does kashem mean? There's a deeper shared emotional experience that occurs both in Av and both in Adar of finding meaning and finding a passion, a commitment in terms of what we truly believe in. And the Pritzedek, that's how the Pritzedek, the Rav Tzedek of Lublin, that's how he explains the Gemara, that's how he explains the Kashem. There is a simcha in Av, but that simcha is hidden. There's a light that happens in Av, but it's deep inside of us. When, in Yemos HaMashiach, when everything becomes clear, that light of joy, there is a certain kind of joy, but that light of joy will be able to be released in full recognition. So joy and pain, from Hashem's perspective, are two sides of the same coin. We just can't see the coin right now. But they're two sides of the exact same coin. And perhaps the experience of Av and Adar are very parallel with each other. One is finding joy from amidst the pain, and one is finding pain from amidst reduced joy. But they're really two experiences, again, two different ways that we could lead to the same endpoint of enriching our lives with a deeper meaning and a deeper sense of passion. Yes?
Are you defining the labor of shalem as complete heart, or are you defining it as a peaceful heart, so that you accept the good and the bad, or that the good and the bad complete what life is?
Okay, good point. I think both could be right. I think the Shulchan Aruch, I brought the Shulchan Aruch there also. I think Shulchan Aruch is probably the first idea that you mentioned, closer to the first idea, but I think it could be both. That's a good point. So, let's try to figure out why this is the... We know by Yom Tovim. Yom Tovim have what I call, I think the Rav might mention it as well, a heroic joy. It's this joy where mourning doesn't exist. Nothing, everything else gets wiped out. Yom Tov has this joy which takes over everything else that we should enjoy every single second. Why does Adar perhaps have this joy that's interlaced with this pain, that joy from amidst the cracks of pain? Why does Adar have this unique simcha experience, and a different kind of simcha experience, perhaps a different explanation of the word simcha than the simcha of that we use by Yontif. So let's go back to one of the questions that we asked originally of why Adar. What's so special about Adar? So any ideas? Why did this idea of Mishnechas Adar Marvin B'Simcha? Okay, B'Nafochu from what?
From the main holiday of Purim, that phenomenon of turning things around is a major source of joy. That things that are bad turn out to be for the best.
Mm-hmm. So there's a specific idea related, embedded within that Purim experience, which transfers over to the rest of Adar. Okay, so thank you. Obviously, that's how most Mefarshim explain that Gemara, that Mishnechas Adar Marvin B'Simcha is related to Purim. There are other shitos, though. Sfas Emes, in a couple places, amongst others, says that it's actually Mishnechas Adar Marvin B'Simcha is actually not related to Purim. It's actually related to the Mitzvah of Shkalim, which had a unique element of Simcha related to it. But let's take your assumption, and I think it's a pretty good assumption that it's related to Purim as well. Let's see. Perhaps we have this concept that's related to the Purim story and the Purim experience. So the whole Megillah starts in a very... let's look at the Megillah for a little bit. The whole Megillah, or the idea of Purim, the whole Megillah starts in a very ominous way of Vayehi. We know the word Vayehi typically connotes negative ideas, it's something to look out for. And the Megillah is interlaced with the tune of Eicha. By the way, one of the explanations for why Vayehi typically connotes bad things to come, psychological explanation, I think from the Beis Yishai, Shlomo Fisher from Har Nof, he explains that there's two different kinds. I'm also, not only am I not a Greek expert, I'm also not a grammarian by any means at all, but there's two different kinds of vavs that could be found in the beginning of a word. There's the conjunctive vav, the additive vav, where it just means and. There's another kind of vav, the vav ha'ipuch, which transfers the tense from... If it's a past tense, transfers it to future tense. So vayihi doesn't mean, yihi means will be, vayihi means and it was. The vav changes it from a future tense to a past tense. Or v'haya kisavo, it changes it from and it was. Haya means was, v'haya means and it will be. Right? I think I'm right about that so far. So yihi is, we want something to happen, we want it to be in the future. If we're despondent, if we're depressed, we want the future, can be hopeless and can seem we could feel hopeless and we could feel helpless. So we want the future to be in the past. We want the yihi to be above. We want to change it. We want the future to be in the past. We don't want the future to be the future anymore. We want it to be behind us. When we're in positive spirits, positive things, good things, the past, everything that's already happened to us, we want it to continue. Vihaya. Haya, what was? Vih. We want it to continue. We want to change it to continuing together in the future because we're savoring what's currently happening for us. Anyway, but even in, as I said, so the Megillah starts with Vayehi. And there's the tune of Eicha. There's even kind of, even within the Megillah itself, there's been the Vinahatachu for sure, but there's a lot of negative elements or painful elements within the Megillah. The Gemara Megillah in source 12 has a question of, even though it's a question of who we possibly like, the Gemara Megillah gives three different explanations for why we do not say Hallel on Purim. So according to two of the three explanations, I think it fits with the theme that we're developing, that that it's true, the Gemara Megillah says, it's true that it was a nace, and we were saved, but the full joy seems to be lacking. Why? It's not, we can't do a full celebration so much so that we would say Hallel. Why? According to the first answer, we're still in Galus, we're not in Eretz Yisrael. And we can bitterly relate to this, obviously, today. We're not in Eretz Yisrael. It's a nace that happened outside of Eretz Yisrael. How could there be a full celebration that you would say Hallel for a nace that's still in Galus? So, again, there's a bittersweet element to Purim. Yes, there was a nace, but there's still some Galus happening here. And according to the third explanation, the third answer in the Gemara says, actually read in line, I think it's pretty chilling when you read the words, Rav Amar, second to last line, Bishlama Hasam Ahalu Avdei Hashem V'Avdei Paro. By Pesach, it makes sense to say Hallel because we say we're Avdei Hashem. We're no longer Avdei Paro, we're Avdei Hashem. Elahacha, Halu Avdei Hashem V'lo Avdei Achashverosh. Akati Avdei Achashverosh Anan. How can we say we're Avdei Hashem? The end of the story, the end of the Megillah is we're still subject to Achashverosh's rule. This isn't a full salvation. There's something missing in the Purim story. We haven't reached a full Yeshua in the Purim story. Even textually of the Megillah, I think this idea happens over and over again. I was fortunate enough to take Rav Chaim Angel in YU, when I was in YU, an undergraduate, for Bible, and I took him for Chumash Megillah, so a lot of these ideas, even from textually, is based on his teachings. That if you look at the Pesukim, I'm not going to go through them, but I put in the Mekoro sheet. Even after initially choosing Esther, there's a second beauty contest. Achashverosh again has another beauty contest after choosing Esther, reinforcing this idea that there's really not a lot of stability here for Esther. Esther, as is a theme throughout the Megillah, Esther is still in a very precarious situation. Yes, she won, and she's now Queen Esther. But yet, right away, there's another beauty contest reinforcing this vulnerability. And Esther says so explicitly in Perek Dalet when talking with Mordechai that she is in a very precarious situation. She doesn't have, just because she's the queen, she doesn't have a lot of guarantees. And even the juxtaposition. In the last pasuk in Perek Beis, the story about Mordechai saving Achashverosh's life is written in the Sefer Divrei Yamim, in Achashverosh's presence. And then instead of rewarding Mordechai, what's the contrast? The very next pasuk at the beginning of Perek Gimel is about Haman's promotion to second in command. A very nice, sharp juxtaposition there, showing that, again, you could save the king's life, and yet, what's going to happen right away, Haman rises, not Mordechai. We know Haman wants to kill the Jews because they're the Jews, we're the Jews. But in Perek Gimel, it's very ambiguous. Yes, it's true, it's possible that Achashverosh knew who Haman was referring to. Haman never explicitly says to kill the Jewish people. He recalls them, you know, I'm the Fuzar, he refers to them in a certain kind of way. It's perhaps possible, but just textually, he never identifies the Jews as the nation to kill, which makes it even more chilling that Achashverosh just says, yeah, okay. Whoever you're talking about, I'm not even sure which nation you're talking about, but yeah, you can kill them. So Haman is bad. We know that. Haman is evil. Achashverosh is evil in a different kind of way. Perhaps Achashverosh is giving the okay to kill a nation. He doesn't, which is scary enough, he doesn't even know who the nation is. It's not even coming from specific anti-Semitism or hate. It's coming because of a bribe, because of drinking, whatever it's becoming from. Power, whatever it's coming, and that's a very scary thing. And that's the same person, obviously, who we're still, at the end of the story, still Avdei Achashverosh. That same person, this impetuous, unpredictable person, is still the king. Even the way the Megillah ends, the Megillah does not end with the story of Achashverosh's wealth and power. it ends with, it doesn't end with the celebration, it ends with explanations of Ahasuerus's power, that he accepted taxes, and talking about his own strength, to reinforce this idea that even at the end of the story, we're not so different than how we were at the beginning of the story. The Gran Mishle explains a pasuk that Ravo Sadikim Yismach Ha'am, when Sadikim are winning, so to speak, then the nation will rejoice. Uvimshol Rasha Yenach Ha'am. And when the Rishayim are ruling, then the nation will groan. So the Gran Mishle explains that this refers to Haman and Mordechai. In the times of Haman, pain actually has to be, he makes a diak on the pasuk, but pain, we can't even express our pain outwardly. We have to express our pain inwardly. But perhaps in the times of Mordechai, when Tzaddikim are ruling, then we could express our pain. Pain, being able to express our pain, is a show of simcha in some ways. Okay. There are a lot of other ideas. Again, I'm not going to go into detail. I'll say this very quickly. But a lot of ideas about Purim also that again, show the interlacing of pain and simcha. Perhaps, by the way, on Purim is also when Makas Choshech was most severe in the world, when 12 million Jews were killed. That was on Purim. We're celebrating Purim, but it's also a day of national tragedy in some ways. This idea of Purim has to be attached to Tanis Esther, but Tanis Esther itself, it's obviously a Tanis, but on the same time, we're allowed to engage in joyful activities on a Tanis. Again, painful elements interlaced with the joyous elements. Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach explains that one of the minhagim, Mishnah Chasadr Marim Simcha, what's the answer? What's one of the things we do? We put up the signs. We put up the signs, I don't know if you've seen them. Mishnah Chasadr Marim Simcha. You put them up all over the place. So according to Rav Avram Lipschitz, in his parish in Shulchan Aruch, he says, where should you place the signs of Mishnah Chasadr Marim Simcha? Specifically on the makom korban of where you do Zecher L'Chorban. Right where you have Zecher L'Chorban, you also put the sign of Mishnah Chasadr Marim Simcha. Can anything be more literal than what we're talking about? The interlacing, the integrating of the joyous and the painful elements all in one place right there. You have the unfinished part of your house, of the shul, Mishnah Chasadr of the Zecher L'Chorban, and yet right there, you also have Mishnah Chasadr Marim Simcha at the same time. Even drinking wine. We started off with the question of the Chasam Sofer. Let me finish this part with the drasha from the Chasam Sofer. Even drinking wine, that perhaps the most joyful or explicitly joyful element of Purim, is interlaced with pain. Chasam Sofer quotes the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which says the whole purpose for the creation of wine was to comfort mourners. On Purim, the Chasam Sofer explains shockingly, we're somewhat like mourners, all of us. There are these tragic elements that remain even at the end of the Purim story. And it is very painful. We are still in Gullus. We drink so much wine because we're mourners. That's the way we could feel simcha, by drinking so much wine to overcome the sense of mourning, the sense of loss that accompanies the Chag of Purim. There is a simcha element, but we drink the wine to make sure that we can cover up and we can at least overcome the painful elements to feel this joy. So much so that he says in another drasha that we should drink so much of wine that it should be as if the Beis Hamikdash was rebuilt. Not possibly that la'alacha for anyone, okay? Just want to make that clear. But again, so we see this idea over and over again. Adar is about finding joy from amidst the pain. Or maybe perhaps Adar is about finding joy because of the pain. On Yontif, the Gra famously said that was the hardest mitzvah. On Yontif, you had to be in the Gra said it was the hardest mitzvah. He had to be besimcha every single second. It had to overcome any single other element, any painful element. There couldn't be any second of Yontif that was experienced without joy. On Purim, and during Adar, we're trying to find the joy amidst the pain that's still present. Perhaps we could explain psychologically how pain, perhaps, could actually increase our experiences of joy. So there are at least two natural tendencies which prevent us from feeling pain and anxiety. The first one is called in the literature hedonic adaptation, studied by many, 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 many people. It's the ability to adjust. It's a bracha on both sides for sure, but psychologically, when painful events happen to us, humans are extremely resilient. We're built to be resilient. It's a huge bracha from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that even when painful events happen, eventually, we typically recover. There are some exceptions, but typically, and there's been research in so many areas, and actually, there's a chart on second to last page. You could actually look at different events for men and women, how they recover from positive events and negative events. Typically, negative events, people come pretty close to recovering or fully recover, or actually, in certain cases, actually typically even do better than they were originally. And positive events, unfortunately, goes the other way also. No matter the positive event, we'll also adjust to the positive event also. So we might peak up, but eventually we'll get close to where we were before. So it's a bracha that when negative things happen, we're pretty resilient. We adapt. But the same thing is true even euphoria. Euphoria and joy do not last. When positive things happen, we quickly adjust as well. The reasons for that are based on the acronym AREA, A-R-E-A. First, we attend to an event. We experience an event, we orient to it. A, R, we react. Okay, so emotionally we have some kind of reaction. If it's a painful event, we experience pain. If it's a positive event, we experience joy. E, but then we explain the event. We put it into a context. We try to process it and give an explanation for the event. And then eventually, once we've processed it and given an explanation for it, we fit it into a box. A, we adapt. We kind of adjust back up or adjust back down, pretty close to it. And so that's one reason. The adaptation is one reason why we experience pain, but we quickly adjust from it. There's another reason, which is pretty simple to understand: experiential avoidance. We don't like feeling pain. Feeling pain is uncomfortable. Feeling pain is painful. So we don't like feeling pain. And I'll talk about this a little bit more in a second. Let's talk about some ways that pain can increase happiness. Pain can actually increase joy. So if you could look at a chart, the chart on page 8, this chart over here. So this chart is, she didn't actually make it. I actually emailed her. She got it from someone else. But a researcher in Stanford who does a lot of research and doing great research right now. I really like her research. I'm going to quote it again a little bit later. Sonia Lubomirsky from Stanford. She does a lot of happiness research. So this is extremely hard to understand. You know, I can't necessarily, obviously I can't say that I'm the role model for this or that I necessarily understand it, but some people, when a challenge or tragedy happens, some people really are just holding on for dear life. Those are in the survival. That's A. Tragedy happens and it's hard for them to adapt and they kind of stay in survival mode. Some people eventually kind of like we go up and recover eventually. Sometimes it takes longer, sometimes it takes shorter, but goes back to their original level. There are those who are in the sea level, who are remarkable people, who are able to thrive. They're actually able to reach a higher level because in the face of tragedy. And she explains that perhaps tragedy and pain can trigger a renewed belief in their ability to persevere and endure. It could actually improve relationships because the people that count come in and then the relationships become much deeper, much closer for people who step in during the face of tragedy. Shows true friends. People can become more comfortable with emotional intimacy because of this life-threatening challenge or whatever it is that occurred to them that kind of made things, put things in perspective. It could develop a more sensitive, more valued concept of life, and perhaps we could say she did not mention this, and perhaps we can relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a new or deeper kind of way as well. So some people, tragedy can trigger actually an increased level of joy in life. Pain can help accentuate the joyful events also. If you can look on the bottom again of page 8. All right, Brian, can I ask, can you read that, what that says?
It almost says, I'm not sure if it says HHT or AAT.
So it either says HAT or HHT or AAT. Okay. Can you turn the page or turn around to the next page and look on the top there? What does that say?
It probably says the and then CAT or CHT.
So
I'm not sure what to say here. The cat, I
guess. The cat. Okay, thank you. We did not plan that beforehand, believe it or not. So the cat. Now those are the exact same letters as over here. When we have it on the previous, those are the exact same. These two letters are identical, and the H and A in the cat are identical. When we have the letters together, it's Rabbi Brand's confusion. I'm sorry to put you in that position, but that makes a lot of sense. We can't because when things are similar, we can't discriminate. Everything seems to be the same. They blur together. When we have the contrasting elements, typically it's pretty clear that it might say the cat. And I could have shown another one that could have said the cat in the hat, and that would have been the word beforehand. We could make that word into hat. All of a sudden, if I put the cat, I purposely did it like this, but if I put the cat together with that word, I'm pretty sure it would have been read easily as hat, the cat in the hat, because we have the contrasting elements. When things are so similar, they blur together. But when we have contrasting elements, our minds are attuned to be able to see them in a different kind of way. Think about it. On the rare 50-degree day in Chicago in February. We were whipping out the short sleeves. This is like the greatest day in the world. 50-degree day in August. We are bitter. We are angry. It's all based on context. And in fact, this is the very, very recent literature in Sonia Lubomirsky about why we adapt to different joyful events. There's two different reasons why we don't stay happy when a good event happens to us. According to the first path, it's because something spectacular happened. We won the lottery. We got married. A joyful thing happened. But those joyful events will eventually diminish, right? We got married. That's a big joy. We had the Sheva Brachos, but then it goes back to real life. We won the lottery. That was a really remarkable, amazing thing. But then we have the same money in the bank account this month as next month. The joyful events are not occurring as much. But there's a second element, which might perhaps seem a little bit counterintuitive, but maybe it wouldn't based on what we just talked about. When something joyful happens, it now shifts our perspective on what's necessary, what we need, what happiness is. We've kind of grown accustomed to this, and our standards have changed. Now that we've experienced this super joy, now in order to increase our joy, we need super, super joy. Super joy is not going to cut it anymore. We need super, super joy. We need the contrast. The contrast is what we see. So an appreciation is the psychological opposite of adaptation. Rather than taking X for granted and no longer noticing it, the smaller things in life, appreciation is still seeing the smaller things in life and recognizing it, not losing sight of it, amplifying our attention towards those smaller things. So perhaps when negative events happen, or the contrast between negative and joy, that can make our joy so much more lasting and so much stronger, because we can see the joy amidst the pain, which even enhances the joy experience itself. We don't lose sight of the joyful experiences. We amplify our joyful experiences. Look at the joy, even amongst the pain, it creates a much richer, much more intense, much more passionate experience. I talked before about experiential avoidance, how we don't typically want to engage in painful events. People with panic disorder, people who are scared of getting a panic attack while driving, they're not going to drive. People who have social anxiety, they're going to limit themselves from going into crowds. But by limiting themselves from feeling that pain, they're actually increasing the pain. The more you avoid going into cars, the more a person with social anxiety avoids crowds, the more isolated and lonely that they're likely to become. We feel pain. We typically only feel emotional pain about things that matter to us. We don't typically feel emotional pain about things that don't really matter to us. So if we're avoiding the pain about things that matter to us, and that's what we're avoiding, well, the more we avoid things that matter to us, the more painful things are going to be. So there's this idea in, it's called third wave of cognitive behavioral therapy, about a willingness and acceptance to be able to engage in pain. Acceptance, one definition that I really like, there's a few definitions. One definition of acceptance of pain. Again, acceptance of pain, it's used in a different way than just saying, it's okay that something bad happened to me. That's not what acceptance means in this context. Acceptance can be defined as the behavior of approaching psychologically aversive or troubling internal stimuli while behaving adaptively. Still engaging in certain kinds of emotional experiences despite the pain that they might trigger and the anxiety it might trigger. And being okay with that. There was a study by Rick Brown and a number of other people at Brown University where it gave a group of chronic smokers three different purposely annoying tasks. Number one, holding their breath as long as possible. Number two, solving simple but confusing math problems faster and faster while there was an annoying sound playing. And number three, breathing in carbon dioxide, which increases the physiological anxiety experiences. And it tested in those three areas different chronic smokers. People who lasted longer in all three of those annoying tasks were significantly more successful in being able to eventually quit smoking than those who performed worse. Why? It's not solely the severity or intensity of distress that predicts smoking lapses, but the degree to which an individual is able to tolerate discomfort. So, which predicts success. So, the ability to experience pain and tolerate it is predictive of a life lived within the valued directions, within the goals of a person has, that a person wants to achieve. Their ability to withstand pain with whatever might withstand pain for what's important to them is highly predictive of being able to live a joyful, more experienced life, a joyful experience of life. Okay, I'll be stopping very shortly. Okay, just one more area then I'll discuss. So, according to a researcher in Stanford, you might have heard of him. He's like the big TV presence now for psychologists, Daniel Gilbert. He explained that when less negative events happen, we can actually interpret more negative events in a more positive way than less negative events happen. It's very hard to interpret stubbing our toe or not having a pen when we need it in a positive way. But when something more negative happens, our psychological immune system kicks in. Because then, something really negative happened. This compels us to now give a new explanation for why that negative event happened. We have our psychological immune system like, oh, this is really bad. I have to put a context to it. I have to explain it. So he quotes a couple of research experiments that show this idea that volunteers were invited to join some kind of group in college, and they were given different kinds of shocks. They were given one group was given severe shocks. This was not done recently. Yeah. One group was given severe shocks. One group was given less severe shocks. The group that received the more severe shocks ended up reporting that they enjoyed the group much more than the people who experienced the less severe shocks. Their psychological immune system kicked in to say, this was worth it. This really, I went through this for a reason, for something that was really meaningful to me. People actually reported, if they thought that it was important and meaningful, they actually reported severe shocks as less painful than people who did not think they were suffering for a greater purpose. And then finally, going back to those cards. So 76% of people typically, and it didn't quite reach 76% in this room, but 76% of people reported that the second set of cards that we talked about at the beginning would lead to more happiness than the first card. Why? Because it gave some explanation, even though it didn't really add much to it. It said, who are we? Why do we do this? The first card didn't give that explanation. But according to research, it's actually the opposite. The first set of cards actually led to more happiness. The people who were given the first set of cards reported being happier than the people who were given the second set of cards. Because the explanation is that there's no explanation. And when things don't quite have an explanation and don't fit, they stick to us a little bit more. Like if there's a movie that has this like ambiguous ending, we'll be thinking about that movie a lot longer than a movie that kind of wrapped everything up in a nice bow. It'll stay with us more. A joyful experience that has some kind of mystery to it that doesn't necessarily fit neatly into this box will have more stickiness, and will stay with us a little bit more. Once people succeed in making sense of an event, it no longer seems as surprising or as unexpected. And our reward pathways in our brain were activated not by the strength, not by the valence of a stimulus, but by its lack of predictability. So, why do we have a simcha of Adar? What does it mean? How do we celebrate it? Why is there still pain attached to it? There's a mystery of Adar. It's not so clear. It's a little bit ambiguous. And why does the Shulchan Aruch and Rambam not bring it down? We have some answers. It's still a little bit mysterious. Perhaps, Al Pi Drush, perhaps we could say, that this mystery of the Simcha, the secret Simcha of Adar, the fact that it's not so clear-cut and obvious, perhaps that could actually make the Simcha even more powerful and even more everlasting. Have a happy rest of Adar and happy Simcha.
We'll just take a few minutes now before the next session. Yeah.